nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so today I'd like to continue our discussion from last day, which basically is about this topic of what's called thermoelectricity. And what I want to point out is, although usually you think of, if you look at the usual literature, you'd have thought of thermoelectricity as a totally different subject. But the point I wanted to make is that basically there's not much new that you need to learn. What I mean is, this equation that we had written down at the beginning of the course, you know, where we said that if you have a certain density of states and you want to calculate the current, well, it's given by this density of states, the rate at which electrons go in and out, and usually you had a gamma 1 and a gamma 2. Here I've assumed those two are equal, which is why instead of gamma 1, gamma 2 divided by gamma 1 plus gamma 2, I have half a gamma. Okay. And then F1 minus F2. And as we discussed before, this is what applies to a really small device. If you have a relatively long device where how easily an electron gets out from the channel depends on the length of the channel, then this gamma becomes proportional to the velocity, like h bar v over l, and then this density of states times velocity, that's what you call the density of modes. And that's what describes ballistic transport. And then if you want to go to diffusive transport, then you have to add this extra factor of mean free path over mean free path plus length. That's it. I mean, otherwise, this is the basic equation for current flow. And usually, of course, current flows because it is driven by this difference in chemical potentials, mu 1 and mu 2. And that's what makes the two Fermi functions different, F1 and F2. Because, as you know, this Fermi functions will look something like this. Something like this. And so at any given energy, the F1 is the value of this Fermi function, F2 is the value of that Fermi function. And those two are different, and that's what drives current flow. And usually that difference comes from a difference in chemical potentials. But the point is that that difference could just as well have come from a temperature difference also. Even if the two chemical potentials were the same, if the temperatures are different, because as you know, when you heat up a particular contact, that is, if the temperature is higher, it will look like this. And that can give you a difference between F1 and F2. And that essentially is the origin of thermoelectricity. So if you want to describe thermoelectric currents, you could use the same equation. I mean, nothing else needs to change, really. It's just that this F1 and F2, between the two contacts, not only is the chemical potential different, but also the temperature. That's about it, really. Okay? And the one additional thing that one can add to this, which is what I was trying to describe to you last day, and which is kind of what's explained in this, was illustrated in this last homework of this, the third problem of this latest homework, which is that when you think of electrons going through a particular energy level, when it comes in from the contact, it always comes in at mu 1, around the Fermi energy in an ideal contact. But then it has to absorb that much energy in order to get to your particular level, and then it gives up that much energy in getting out. So if you want to write the amount of heat that flows from this contact, so I could write a IQ1. This is real current. This is the current of charge, whereas this is the heat current, how much heat actually gets pulled out of contact 1. You could add that. It'll look exactly the same like we had before. But now we add an extra factor, which is E minus mu 1. Why? Because actually I drop the Q from here. Why is that? Well, you see, if I drop the Q from here, it tells me the rate at which electrons are going from contact 1 to contact 2. And every time an electron goes from one contact to the other, it carries that much charge, which is why the charge current is Q times the rest of it. Now, if you want the energy current, that is how much energy goes, then what you do is you drop the Q. That tells you the rate at which electrons are going. And then every time an electron gets out of this contact, it picks up that much energy. So if I want the heat current out of contact 1, all I do is take the Q out and put in E minus mu 1. Of course, Q is the same for all energies, which is why it was outside the integral. This one is different depending on which energy you're going through, which is why it's inside the integral. That's about it. Okay? Similarly, if you want the heat current in contact 2, you should do much the same thing, you see? And now, instead of E minus mu 1, you put E minus mu 2. That's it. So overall, that's kind of what it should look like. So this we had done back in September. And as I said, generally covers this entire range of transport. And the new things you could add is this heat current idea, if you wanted. That. Which kind of follows from the same. Once you recognize this physical point, that an electron picks up that much energy and drops off that much. And one thing you can see is that if you look at the difference between those two. So can you help me what that would be? What goes in there? Can you help me? Right. So I'm saying E minus mu 2 minus U plus mu 1. So that's mu 1 minus mu 2, which is actually equal to the applied voltage, as you know. So that's like times QV, which is equal to voltage times current. Of course, because if I take this V out of the integral, what's left is basically the expression for the current, of course. So what that tells you is, as you know, V times I, that's the amount of energy per second that comes from your battery. Okay. IQ1, that's the amount of energy the electron sucks from contact 1. And this is what it delivers to contact 2. So what is delivered to contact 2 is equal to what is taken out of contact 1 plus what the battery gives to it. That's the overall energy balance. Okay? And the new aspect of it is that usually you think that, well, you're taking energy from that battery and you're just dissipating it. So that's joule heating. Except that in general, it need not be pure heating. You could be cooling someplace and heating someplace more, actually. Now, often that doesn't happen because you have as many energy levels above you as below you. And so the ones above you, you tend to cool it here and heat it there. The ones below you, you tend to heat it here and cool it there. And so overall, it tends to cancel out. You don't get a net cooling. But if you could arrange a material to have states only above the chemical potential, that would be like an N-type material. Or if it was purely below the chemical potential, that would be like a P-type material, then it would actually lead to cooling or heating of the contacts. And real thermoelectric devices, see, often look something like this. See, there's a surface here. See? a material in contact. So this is a N-type semiconductor. This is a P-type semiconductor. And you put a, say, if you are trying to use this as a generator, then what you could do is just connect a load across this. And the idea is this is, let's say, hot, and this is cold. That would be one way to do things. Right, and the current would flow out here. And the thing is, the N and the P tend to give you a different sense of the voltage so that it adds. You see, what happens is, in the N-type material, electrons want to go from hot to cold. Electrons will want to go from hot to cold. While in the P-type material, actually, electrons will go the other way. This is the thing that we had done back in September, that homework problem, that if you have a level up here, then if this side is hot, then, and let's say the two mu's are the same for the moment, if the two mu's were the same and this side was hot, then F2 would be bigger than F1, and so electrons would want to go this way. On the other hand, if you have a level down here, then F1 would be bigger than F2, and electrons would go the other way. As I said, no new formulas are needed. It just comes out of here. And this is what describes it. The point is we're trying to understand it. And all I'm saying is, if levels are up here, electrons will flow from hot to cold. If electrons are down here, if the level is down here, electrons will flow from cold to hot. And simply because F1 is bigger than F2 in one case, F2 is bigger than F1 in the other case. That's about it. See? Okay. So what happens then is electrons will want to flow this way, and so it forms a nice continuous circuit, and this whole thing then drives your load. And this could then be heated up with some external source. Could be sunlight, could be something else, some source of heat. So this would be a way of, say, converting heat into electricity. This could be a light bulb, for example, something that you light up or some useful work you do by converting heat. And the same thing, if you turn it around, you could actually make a thermoelectric cooler. I believe sometimes the way people do it is what you want to do is, let's say we want to pull electrons in from here. So if you want to cool this, so if you remember, in an N-type material, if you pull in electrons from this side, you'd be cooling this surface. So what you want to do is pull in electrons from here. So think, okay. Okay, do this opposite. I think it goes this way. So if you pulled in electrons, you'd want to cool it. So now, of course, you have to actually supply energy. Here it was like you're taking the thermal energy, converting it into useful work. Here you are actually taking a battery which supplies you with the energy. But in the process, you are trying to cool one surface relative to another, for example. So that's how the thermoelectric coolers would work. And again, the principles are exactly what's laid down here. That's it. Basic same principles. But you can use it both as this and as a cooler. Now, what I wanted to discuss a little more is just these expressions and the usual thermoelectric parameters that people use. That is, for any material, often what people do is they think in terms of this gives you the current for any F. But what you can do, and this is what we have discussed before, that if you wanted to get an expression for, say, the current for a small voltage, then, as you know, you can get an expression for conductance. And how do you do it? Well, you can write this as minus del F del E times QV. And this is like a Taylor series expansion of that. And when you do that, current, you get an expression for current proportional to voltage, and that gives you a conductance. Now, so you could write something like voltage is equal to current divided by conductance. That would be the usual case. Now, in these thermoelectric materials, you also have this additional driving term, which is called the Seebeck coefficient, and that is the temperature difference. So current is driven not only by voltages, but also by a temperature difference. And that's what you call the Seebeck coefficient.
Something that I don't understand is when we have this F1 minus F2, the derivative that we define as from the Taylor expansion, vicinity of which energy level is being taken?
Right. So you're assuming that at equilibrium, F1 would have been exactly equal to F2. So mu1 and mu2 are exactly the same. And then what we are saying is that let us now assume that mu1 is equal to mu2 plus or minus a little bit. So it is about mu. Now, what happens is, and this is the tricky part, is that Fermi function looks like 1 over e to the power e minus mu over kT plus 1. Now, since you are doing this little expansion around mu, you would have said that I really shouldn't write here del F del E. I should write here del F del mu. That would have made good sense. You said, okay, we want to know how much the function changes due to a slight change in mu. And how much did mu change? Well, by QV. Because mu1 is different from mu2 by that amount. Okay. Then the argument is that because of the form of the Fermi function, del F del mu is like the negative of del F del E. Because F is a function of E minus mu. Okay. So it's this two-step argument. And then this is true at all energies. I mean, once we write this, I mean this, I can pull the voltage out of this, and this integral has to be done over all energies, really. This integral's over all energies. Okay. So usually people define the Seebeck coefficient, which is done this way, and if you look at the heat current, then people define something called the Peltier coefficient, which is proportional to the current, and something called the heat conductivity, which is depends on the temperature difference. So the second term would be just the usual heat flow. Namely, whenever there's a temperature difference, you want to have a heat flow. So if heat and electricity were not coupled, then those two terms would not be there. Current, electrical current would depend on electrical voltage. Heat current would depend on temperature difference. Two separate equations, heat flow, current flow, separate things. On the other hand, this Seebeck and this Peltier coefficient, they sort of couple the story, that you can have a current flow due to temperature difference and a heat flow due to a current, etc. Now, this set of equations, you could also turn around and write it a little differently. Namely, instead of having I on this side, I could pull the I to this side and have the V on this side. So, for example, I could do it this way. I is equal to VG and then something else times delta T. So, can you help me with what goes there? You know, I is equal to VG. And then this is GS delta T, which is what goes over to the other side. So I put it GS. I write this as G times V, GS times delta T. You could write it that way. And this one, IQ, this is takes a little more work. I've got it in terms of I and delta T, but I'd really like to make it in terms of V and then delta T. So my question is, can you help me with what goes here and what goes there? So it's this Peltier coefficient times I, and I is this. So I have to take the Peltier coefficient times this. So I get a Peltier coefficient here. And so I get pi gv. That's what will go in there. Plus pi g. Yes. Good. That's it. By the way, this is the Peltier coefficient. It's not the, not 3.14. Right? No confusion here. This is Peltier coefficient. Just happens to be written that way. Yeah. Okay. So these are just two equivalent ways of writing this. Right? Now, what's nice about this one is that if I started from this set of equations and did a Taylor series expansion, that is, I say F1 minus F2 is this thing times voltage, I could do something equivalent for temperature. I could say, again, something times delta T. Then I'd end up with expressions like this. And so this one, by doing simple linear expansions, I could turn into this. So often you see the equations in this form, and then people give you an expression for this, 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 etc. On the other hand, when people actually experimentally measure it, and then you have to look for the values of the parameters, what you'll see is this, which is why, you see, people don't quite have symbols for these things. So no one quite tells you what's the value of GS, not quite. What they'll tell you is what's the conductance, what's the thermopower or Seebeck coefficients, that's the S. They'll tell you what's the Peltier coefficient, pi, and they'll tell you what's the heat conductivity. So those are the parameters you would actually look up someplace. That's what people have measured. That's what people talk in terms of. Every one of these coefficients has a name, whereas here, these are all nameless things. There's nothing there. Okay. But these are equivalent, so you can always go back and forth between them. Okay. And there's one very interesting relationship that was actually discovered long before people understood in any way about the microscopically how this comes about. This was understood like before quantum mechanics and all that, before that. And that is that this Peltier coefficient and this Seebeck coefficient are related. And the relation is this pi equals Ts. So that's called the Kelvin relation, I believe. And this was, again, people had come up with this from measurements and from thermodynamic arguments and all that, long before you understood. But if we just took these things and did a Taylor series expansion, you'd find, indeed, that all works out. It takes a little algebra to get there, but you can see that all works out. In fact, what we'll try to show you quickly then is that think of a simplest device, and you can see why you must have this relationship. Simplest device meaning, let's think of a device with just one level. So let's say I have single level here, and you have mu 1, this is epsilon, and you have mu 2, and this T2, this is different temperature T1, and let's say T2 is greater than T1, which means this is the hot side, this is the cold side. And the argument I went through last day, what we want to do is, this is the simplest device with just one level. Question is, what is its Seebeck coefficient and what is its Peltier coefficient? Let's just write that down, and you'll see in a minute that it should really look like this. It really takes, literally a minute, really. And the way I do it is, for the Seebeck coefficient, we went through this argument last day, namely that Seebeck coefficient means you're looking for this. You're asking that for a given temperature difference, what must be the voltage difference such that I equals 0.
So if you had an open circuit situation with current equal to 0, how much voltage would you have for a given temperature difference? And the argument I made before is that, well, the way you can get an open circuit situation, I mean no current flows, is because at this energy, F1 is equal to F2. And if F1 is equal to F2, then what must happen is epsilon minus mu1 over KT1 must be equal to epsilon minus mu2 over KT2. So, because the Fermi F1 at epsilon depends on that quantity, F2 at epsilon depends on that quantity, and if they have exactly balanced each other out so no current flows, then those two must be equal. And then what I had argued last day is that whenever A over B equals C over D, that's equal to A minus C over B minus D. And that's how we got the relation mu1 minus mu2 over K D2 minus T1. So this is the voltage difference, I guess Q times the voltage difference, and that's the temperature difference. So this is like the Seebeck coefficient, really. So what that tells you is that for a device like this, the Seebeck coefficient is equal to epsilon minus mu1 divided by Q times T1. I have to divide by Q because this is in energy, electron volts. So you have to divide by the charge on an electron to get it in volts. Right? So in other words, the actual voltage is not mu1 minus mu2, it's mu1 minus mu2 divided by Q. So if I really want the Seebeck coefficient, I'd put a Q there, a Q here, and a Q here. So that's the Seebeck coefficient, and I could write it this way or this way. And if we are talking of small voltages, which is what, you know, in this linear regime people are talking of, then I don't need to distinguish between mu1 and mu2. I mean, those are the same thing. So it's epsilon minus mu over qt, basically. Either one you could write. Okay. So that's the Seebeck coefficient. Now you could ask, well, what's the Peltier coefficient? So for Peltier coefficient, the way you should think is, let's say there is no temperature difference, and we're just running a current. How much heat is absorbed from here, right? So this is heat current per charge current. And you can see how much heat current per charge current you should get. You see, every time an electron goes through, it carries an amount of charge Q, and it carries an amount of heat epsilon minus mu1. That's the energy it takes, and that's the charge it takes. So the ratio of heat current to charge current must be epsilon minus mu1 to Q. So pi for a device like this must be epsilon minus mu1 over Q. That's it. And now you see, of course, immediately that comes to, you know, S over T. T1, or I guess if I'm looking for the heat removed from here, if I'm looking at the Peltier coefficient of this side, then I'd use that one. But basic idea is there. So you can just see immediately why you need to have that particular relationship of the two kind of relay. Okay? But this is much more general, though. It's like for a single level, you can see this. What if you had many, many levels? Well, that's when I'd say that, you know, the expression I had written down before, you know, which I just wiped out from here, let me just write it again. So the expression I had before, if you remember, IQ1 is equal to So this is the expression I had written for how current amount of heat absorbed from contact one. And the thing is, I'd say that if you look at just one level, that means you kind of drop the integral. So as if you just got one level, then what you have is just the rest of it. You know, Q over H bar, gamma over 2, E minus mu 1. So this idea that how much heat, every time you go through a level, the amount of heat you absorb is epsilon minus mu 1. And then if you have a distribution of levels like this, lots of them, then the thing is that in a given energy range, the number of levels you have is density of states times the energy range. So you could write the amount of heat removed as electrons go through that level as d this times whatever we had. And then if you want to add it up over all levels, you integrate it. That's basically the justification for this. Okay. Yes, please. Thank you. Thank you. Very good. Yeah. And that was the Kelvin. Okay, so I wrote it right here. Okay. So thank you very much. Right? So for a single level then, it's just almost two lines to see why you must have this Kelvin relationship. You know, two very different effects. Seebeck effect, that's this idea that you have a temperature difference, leave it open circuit, you'll get a voltage. That's the Seebeck coefficient. The Peltier coefficient is that if you actually put an external voltage and drive it, you'll cool one of the junctions. The first one is sort of the basis for using thermoelectricity as a solar generator, as a heat, as an electricity generator, right? Because you have an open circuit voltage, you can use it to drive a load. This one is the basis for using it as a cooler. You're actually supplying energy and cooling something. But the point is, those are related. And whatever makes a material good for one also helps make it good for the other, usually. Yeah.
You said that Q should be removed then.
Thank you. Right. So when I'm writing a charge current, I put a Q. When I'm writing the heat current, I should take out the Q and instead put in the energy. Yeah, that's the argument. Okay. So for a single level, you can easily see what will happen. For multiple levels, then, you can get an expression for this quantity Gs, this quantity pi G, etc. Okay. Now, the one I wanted to talk a little more about is this heat current, this heat, this kappa, or this one. Now, question is, if you had a single level, what would the kappa be? Now, let me step back for a minute. What does this represent? This represents the heat conduction. Namely, if there is a temperature difference, how much heat is carried. And the thing is, this usually has two components. One part of it is due to the electrons. Namely, if I maintain those two sides at two different temperatures, let's say this is hot and this is cold, heat will want to flow this way, even if there is no voltage difference. So let's say, and question is, how much heat would flow? And part of it is because of electrons flowing, and part of it is because of phonons. Phonons meaning that if you have any solid at two different temperatures, on the hot side, the lattice is jiggling much more violently than on the cold side. And this jiggling wants to get transmitted. And that's the usual heat conduction. I mean, most of the heat conductivity really usually comes from the lattice. So that's what you call the lattice conductivity. Okay? Which is a totally different mechanism, which of course won't be described by anything we have discussed, because we haven't really talked about how phonons flow through a device or that part of it. Heat flow we haven't really talked about. That's a separate issue. But then the electrons themselves can also carry some heat. And that's this part. See? And in trying to design good thermoelectric materials, you usually want to make this as small as possible also, because this kind of gets in the way. That is, you're trying to maintain a temperature difference and you want to run, use it to generate electricity. But then because of the temperature difference, there's always this heat flowing that wants to equalize the temperatures, and you have to work against it. So it would really be good if you had a material which had very poor thermal conductivity. And most of it usually comes from the lattice, but now people seem to have figured out a way of making, of doing things to a material that would mess up its the lattice conductivity without messing up the electronic conduction. Now, in that case, of course, if you really can suppress the lattice conduction, after that, the heat conduction due to the electrons then becomes important. And then you worry about, well, how much is this and how can I make it smaller? But ordinarily, people don't worry about it so much because they say, well, it mainly comes from something else anyway. Okay. But what I'm talking about now is just the electronic part then. Okay. Now, my first point I want to make is, if you just had one level there, the kappa would be zero. If you just had one level. Why is that? Well, because if you look at this, let's say, how do I find kappa? The idea is you put I equal to zero. And then you ask that if there's a temperature difference, how much heat current will flow? Now, the way I described it to you, you see, if there's a temperature difference, but then I've adjusted things that, such that no current flows, then there shouldn't be any heat flow either. No electrons are flowing anyway at all. Okay. Now, of course, that does not mean that this will be zero. This will not be zero because in order to find this, I have to assume that the voltage is zero. And then if I have a delta T, there is actually a current anyway. And once there's a current, it can also remove heat. Remember, in order to find this, I set V equal to zero and ask how much heat current flows for a given delta T. In order to find this, I set the current to zero. And of course, when there is no current flowing, you'd say, well, if there's only one level, there shouldn't be any heat conduction either, because no electrons are flowing. Okay? But if you had more than one level, like if you had a density of states of some kind, distribution of states, then what I want to show is then even this is not zero. This one. Let's say we have two levels. Now the question is, what will be the open circuit voltage? You know, so the way I'm thinking is, you want to go to this open circuit situation, no current flows, and you ask for what is the heat current. And as long as there's one level, the way you have open circuit situation is you adjust things so that F1 is equal to F2, no current flows. Now the thing is, if you have two levels, then it's hard to adjust F1 equal to F2 at this energy as well as at that energy. You see, because if you had only this one, let's say you want to put it here, you know, a given voltage difference that depends on epsilon minus mu. But for that one, you actually need a bigger voltage to start. You need something, this one will require a different voltage. Why? Because it's epsilon minus mu is bigger. So it has a bigger Seebeck coefficient in a way, that other one. So this one might want that much voltage. That this one will want a different voltage, something, let's say, a little bigger. So in order to stop current from flowing in this one, you need some voltage. In order to stop it from that one, you need more. So finally, you'll get zero current by going somewhere in between. It will be neither this nor this. And so when you have actual open circuit, what happens is you have actually electrons flowing, current is not zero through both levels, but what happens is there is electrons flowing in both but in opposite direction, because the actual voltage is a little more than what one wants and it's a little less than what the other one wants. So it's kind of going two ways. And so what will happen is you'll have currents, say, flowing this way on one, this way on the other, and then the currents will cancel out. So there won't be any charge current. But because you know, the reason they cancel out is, you know, the rate at which electrons are going this way on this level is exactly balanced by that. But you see, this one carries more energy than that, because this one, every time an electron comes in, is taking that much energy. This one is only taking that much. So the overall, there'll be a heat current anyway, although the charge current is zero. So the point I'm trying to make is that if you just consider one level, then this would have been zero, because the only way you stop charge current is by just having no current flow at all. But when you have many levels, then you can have zero current and still have currents flow in each of these levels. And the entire charge current balances out, but the heat current doesn't. So there's still a heat current flowing. And that's kind of the origin of this electronic part of the heat conduction, the kappa. You see? And so there's an expression for this that, you know, I wrote down the expressions for the charge current. This is the heat current. And if you take this part and separate it out as something times the voltage and something times delta T, then the coefficient out here, that's what will give you the electronic part of that quantity, if you will, etc. So, and this is the thing I'm not going through, but, you know, if you actually wanted to get the standard expressions for these things in terms of voltage and delta T for linear response, what you'd have to do is take F1 minus F2 and write it as this Taylor series thing. So it would be del F del E times voltage and then something else times delta T. You'd have to do, that's what you'd have to go through, yeah. Say this again.
You take a state E which is above mu 1 and mu 2. You have to take a state which lies between mu 1 and mu 2. Suppose it's less than mu 1 and greater than mu 2. How will the whole thing change?
Right. The expression, these expressions are still fine. Right? Now, physically, if you have a level that is somewhere between mu 1 and mu 2, something here, those levels actually are really, you know, current is, if it's current flowing this way, it's kind of doing this. So you're really heating both contacts. So as far as thermoelectricity is concerned, this part of the electrons is just a complete waste. So what you really try to do when you're designing a thermoelectric material is not have any density of states around here. So you try to have either an N-type material where all your density of states happens to be above mu, or a p-type material where everything is below. And anything in between is just a complete waste, you see? Because it's just giving ordinary heating. It just gets in the way of everything, right? Right. But the basic equations, of course, are these. These just take care of the whole thing. And as I said, when you are trying to get linearized expressions like this, what you have to do is expand the F1 minus F2 in a Taylor series. But then if you don't want linear expressions, you want to deal with large voltages and, you know, say all these thermionic coolers where actually the voltages applied are often large, then what you do is just go back to that equation. I mean, then you are fine. If you work with that, everything's covered, right? As I said before, in terms of calculating it, this is it. What takes much more time is then understanding it, and that's what you're really trying to do here. Calculating, I mean, that's all there is to it. Okay. Now, one other point I guess we have just a few minutes, I'll just finish up by pointing out that usually, if you're thinking of, say, using this device, let's say as a generator or as a cooler, either way, there's these figures of merit that people talk about. And one of them, that's the most common one that you see, actually, way you can understand it is, if you think of this acting as a generator, you could kind of draw an equivalent circuit looking like this. Now, this is the Seebeck coefficient times delta T. That's this voltage. So this heat source that is maintaining the delta T and gives you a voltage source like that, and which has a source resistance G,
And this is then what you are using to drive your load. So sort of visualize it that way. And then if you ask yourself, what's the maximum power I could get out of this? What would that be for a given voltage source with a source resistance? As you know, it's usually this V square over the source resistance. Possibly there's a 4 here, which comes to V squared G over 4. So you can kind of see that the amount of power you can get out of this will be something like S square delta T square times G. No. And then a factor of 4 and all. I'm not worrying about constants. You're saying S squared G delta T squared. So that would be the kind of power you could hope to draw from this. Okay? So from this point of view, you think that the basic figure of merit that we are trying to find a good thermoelectric material, what you should be trying to do is maximize this. And you can kind of see that those things are, it's like what maximizes this tends to make that smaller. And the reason is, as I mentioned before, that if you just wanted to get a great Seebeck coefficient, you know, great open circuit voltage, then what you should do is put some level way up here. Then in order to stop current from flowing through that one, you'd need a very big voltage difference, actually. But it's just that if it's up there, the conductance G would be extremely low. Because F1, you know, the Fermi function is almost gone by the time it's up there. So there's hardly any electrons flowing. You see? And so if it's up there, it's like, yeah, there's a huge open circuit voltage, but then one electron flows every hour. So it doesn't really cool much. Doesn't really do much for you. Right? Which is why usually, of course, people keep it within a few kT. You know, one could argue whether it should be 1 kT or 10 kT, but somewhere in there. But you put it around there. Because, as I say, the higher you put it, the bigger the S, and the but then smaller the G. Okay? So this is one figure of merit, and you can easily see it from a generator point of view, but the same is true from a cooler point of view also. This is what would help you get good cooling. So if you wanted to remove a lot of heat, and there's a lot of interest in, you know, good thermoelectric coolers of this type. I mean, even in your laptops, people wonder whether you could use things like that, because a very big problem with computers these days with laptops is how to cool it. And things like this could be useful, you know, people are looking into all kinds of applications. But then there is another figure of merit, and that's more widely used, which actually looks, this divides this by the thermal conductivity. Actually, there's a dimensionless number, which is S squared GT over K. And this is what people call the ZT of the material. And this usually tends to be somewhere around 1 and 3 or so. And people say that, well, you know, if you could find a material whose ZT is, like, say, 10, that would be really good. I mean, that would really make the industry take off. On the other hand, right now, it's like they're glad if they get 3. It's usually more like 1 or less, from what I know, right? Now, that's the number that the people try to maximize. Now, why is it that the thermal conductivity is important? Well, as I said before, if you're using it as a generator, let's say, then it depends on how much delta T you can get. And for a given heat source, what delta T you can create depends on the thermal conductivity of your material. You see, if all this were extremely conductive, then it's very hard to have a temperature difference across it. You see, somebody has to maintain this temperature difference. And if you have a very high conductivity here, you can't really maintain a good temperature difference. And the same is true when you try to make a cooler. You know, you're removing heat as fast as you can. But then, you see, so this is the cold thing. This is the hot thing. So let's say this is at 300 Kelvin. And you want to cool it to, say, 290 Kelvin. So you are trying to remove heat from here as fast as you can. But then there is always heat flowing from the hot to the cold in the opposite direction. And that's what you have to kind of work against. So how good your cooler is, what temperature difference you get, is affected by this kappa. And so a lot of the improvements in thermoelectric materials so far has come not from improving this,
but actually by making that smaller often. But there are applications actually where this one doesn't matter too much. As I said, like in your laptop with these chips, if you're trying to cool a chip, then the problem is that there's an enormous amount of heat being generated inside, and you're trying to remove this heat. You're not really trying to cool it below room temperature. You're trying to keep it, say, not, you're trying to stop it from going way above room temperature. So let's say this is, say, 320 Kelvin. If it's within 20 degrees, you're happy. You don't want it to just, you know, burn up, basically. Well, then you see, you are trying to remove heat. And the fact that this is higher than this means that the thermal conductivity also makes heat flow this way. So it's really not getting in your way. It's kind of adding to what. So in applications like this, where you're trying to remove heat from a hot thing, then the kappa doesn't matter as much. I mean, it doesn't matter at all, really. If anything, it's helping you. So depending on your application at hand, you could either be looking at that or be looking at that. Right? But most common figure of merit is really this ZT. That's what, if you did a Google search on that, you know, you'd turn up all kinds of nice articles on it, actually. Okay? So let me stop here.